Lifestyle matters. It's more than money.
I'm Faisal Carmelli, my co-host here, Dave Popowich. How are you?
I'm good, Faisal. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. We are warming up, so that's good.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, hopefully that's the last nasty cold streak. I was lucky enough in January to miss that really cold snap.
That's not the last. You're a Calgarian. You know it's not the last one.
Get your own fantasy.
That's yeah, well, after this cold snap that we just had, travel is on a lot of people's minds to get out of here. Yeah. So we're going to be talking about solo traveling on the show. And then we're also going to talk about some futuristic healthcare that's already here for Albertans covered by Alberta Healthcare.
Yeah. And if you listen, if you don't have a primary care doctor, right, you may want to stick around for this and understand a little bit of what's happening.
I think that there's also a lot of people who have to wait weeks to see their family doctor.
You bet.
And so this is a nice alternative covered by the program. And so it's going to be interesting to talk about this futuristic way of doing things.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the futuristic markets that we experienced this week. There's lots of interesting data.
Let's start off with the key piece that came out on Friday. Job numbers on both sides of the border came out better than expected when it comes to the job numbers. And also better when it comes to wage inflation, if you're a business owner in the economy.
Yeah.
Wage inflation.
Or a central banker. Right? Or a central banker to some degree.
Wage inflation is, again, it's one data point. So let's not get ahead of ourselves on the central bankers are going to be all over this. And that's probably what happened early Friday. Wage inflation is still moving up, but it's moving up at a slower pace, which is exactly what inflation is doing.
Yep.
And they're kind of tied. Here's where I think the disconnects happened, what with wage inflation and the economic growth. The old economic assumption that if wage inflation is going down, then you're going to slow down the economy, especially going to slow down inflation. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily true.
Okay, expand on that.
And the reason why I say that is because productivity is a better measurement of economic growth, and it's a better measurement of potential inflation down the road. So when you look at the productivity of the United States, still doing much better. So although you're paying people more, or you're not paying them as much as you were on an increase year over year, they're being more productive. That means they still have cash to spend.
Well, yeah, you're putting out more product, right? Over and above what the extra increase in the pay was, right?
And so I think what we're seeing is a quick decision that, wages are going down, or the wage inflation is going down. Mm-hmm. Therefore, inflation must be going down. Right. It's not that linear.
Yeah, it's one component, right?
Right. And so when you look at those numbers, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Central bankers, I think, are going to do nothing until the second half of the year.
I think that's true. They've guided towards that, right?
And let's not fight the Fed.
Right.
Let's not fight the Fed. Let's listen to exactly what they're saying. We could try to read between the lines, but let's not act on the reaction of the markets based on some data point that doesn't give a full picture of everything.
Yeah. And that creates the volatility. I mean, the bond markets have largely come in line now with the central banker's guidance, right? So we shouldn't be seeing a tremendous amount of volatility coming out of the bond markets, impacting the equity markets, but the timing is still suspect, right? Pricing in, bond markets are pricing in, as we were discussing, a rate cut starting in June. Whether that happens June or July, we'll have to wait and see. So there's still uncertainty moving forward on that.
What this data point and others that we've had this month so far is giving us more evidence of a soft landing versus a recession.
Yeah.
It's giving us more evidence. So That's kind of what the change was there. I think the shock of the week was the New York Community Bank. Mm. NYCB had a capital call, basically. They wanted to kind of raise some capital. The stock fell on the first report from Wall Street Journal and Reuters by 42%, and they froze the halted trading.
Halted trading, yeah.
And then they announced this capital, $1 billion. They talked about, the opportunity there. The stock rallied to end the day 50% higher than the low.
Right.
And then they start to give more information about this. Now, here's where it got really interesting. They took this one community bank focused on multifamily primarily in New York City or New York, and they made that a national news story. Everywhere across the country, real estate's done. The banking sector's in trouble. Watch out.
No. What is there, 3,000 small mid-cap or regional banks in the United States? It's a giant amount.
And not all regional banks are heavily concentrated on real estate, especially in one area. So let's, again, here's the problem. You take a data point of a company who's had some risk on there. And I'm not here to say that the company's a good or bad company. I'm here to say it's a risk to one company. And that just kind of rippled through that the last couple of days about, oh my God, the banking system. As a Canadian, we take this for granted because of our structure, but from a US investor perspective, it kind of shook the market a bit.
Yeah, no, it did. Absolutely. We seem to have a continuation rally in some of the big tech names, right? The AI story still seems to be intact, right?
With the exception to the ones who are AI light or not enough AI.
Right.
So you take on some of the tech companies or companies who don't even talk about adopting any form of AI, haven't been given any love in the markets.
Right.
And so it's thematic. I hate when we say AI, because if anybody actually looks at the definition of AI, it's a lot of things.
Yep. It's broad.
It's so broad. Right. And so to say today, saying AI, it sounds like when we first started in the mid to late 90s, saying just internet.
Right.
This is an internet company.
Yep.
It uses the internet. You're laughing.
I know. I remember those days.
That's exactly what's happened now. It's AI. Yep. We're using AI.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So let's not, again, paint the brush on everything. If just a company says AI, they get the attention.
Right. Is the rally broadening out at all?
Slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's broadening out slowly. When you look at indicators or indexes, that spreads out wider. You're starting to see the love happening. Now, what I like about what's happening this quarter is that the companies whose earnings and revenue are growing, they're being rewarded. Mm-hmm. The ones whose earnings are falling and revenue falling are getting hit harder.
Yeah.
So when you see companies, especially in the non-tech space, get a nice bump up in their stock price because they haven't been given the love or the appreciation, when you look at retail, some of the retail companies that reported this week got a lot of love from the markets because they beat on the top and the bottom line.
And if you didn't,
you got hit.
Oh, yeah, there was no love. These are big swings.
Right. So it's kind of like, you know, it's a little PTSD coming out here. Ready? when I was younger and going to school, if you get A's, you get a little bit of love from the parents.
Yeah.
And if you happen to have a B minus or lower, you're not getting so much love.
Right.
You get told how you're going to be a failure in life, right? And that's exactly what the markets are kind of saying about these companies.
Yeah.
Even though you can turn your marks around, not so much love for the ones who aren't getting a B plus or better.
Yeah, you know, I think the volatility, again, people have to brace for that because you're seeing some big swings, right? It speaks to, again, proper structure and discipline in terms of how you're building your portfolios. Fun on the upside if you get a big 20% pop, but if you get a minus 44 and you're concentrated, that really hurts.
You're going to see a lot more investors jump into the wave of this market, and they're not going to account for the risk.
Right.
And so when this market starts to adjust, and we need a healthy pullback, we need it. You're going to find a lot of people that are going to get so scared and they're going to sell for the wrong reasons, and that's going to hurt a lot of people's, it's going to give a permanent damage to capital.
Faisal, travel is a big part of many people's just lifestyle, and including retirement. Many people are either solo retirees, so they're
correct,
in a situation where maybe they want to travel, but they have to now face traveling alone, or perhaps they're choosing to travel alone.
Correct. And I think your wife said that. She wants to travel alone without you for sure.
Just most of the time, not all of the time.
Seeing how it is traveling with you solo sounds like a great idea for Maddie.
Yeah, we're doing this segment just for her.
Yes. And so let's talk about the opportunities, where the industry is heading, because this is a growing trend.
Yeah.
Not only is it prevalent in North America, but you go across the pond to Europe, they're seeing more and more of that as well. And so where are they doing? Where are they going? What are they doing?
And what's how's the industry, catering to that?
Right? Absolutely.
We've got Leslie Cater, who she's the CEO and the founder of The Travel Lady, to help us understand that very point. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, we've laid it out for you. So why don't we throw the ball over to you and just tell us a little bit about this changing trend towards singles travel, a little about what's happening and why.
Singles travel, I think there's a number of factors involved in here. As you said earlier, some couples don't necessarily want to go to the same places. Also, I find that with the demographics, unfortunately for you guys, women seem to live longer than men. So I have a lot of women who want to travel alone, possibly their widows. And after a lifetime of traveling as a couple, it's a bit difficult to make that leap into solo travel. The main concern, I think, is that people want to feel secure and they want to feel safe. And one of the best ways of doing that seems to be on a cruise, because you're in a contained environment with your tours and meals on board. You're not wandering around a strange city looking for a restaurant. So this is where the cruise lines, I think, have been quite innovative. They have started recognizing this. In fact, Norwegian Cruise Line was the first to recognize this. Gosh, must be 10, 15 years ago mm-hmm. now. They came out with the Norwegian Epic. And that has about 128 studio rooms on board specifically for solos. Now, I must mention for those solo travelers who are listening, these are inside staterooms. And many cruisers don't like the idea of being in an inside stateroom because you might feel a little bit confined, not having a window. Mm-hmm. How would you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that's one thing that when it comes to at least cruising, to be on the inside would be almost claustrophobic.
Well, yeah.
That's how I would feel.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe it speaks to, again, the evolution, right? I mean, the industry has at least recognized the fact that they're, for all the reasons that Leslie just stated, and perhaps as, that evolves, then, the industry will evolve to that and offer, different rooms and accommodations. But beyond just cruising, let's talk a little bit about travel in and of itself, because we have lots of people that are solo retirees, Faisal. And we talk about the fact that a solo retiree, there's a whole bunch of differences, right, in terms of their experience versus a couple.
Yeah, so let me tee this one up as well, because I think we have many of our solo retiree clients who are, I would say, more introverted. They don't have that ability or willingness to actually do something that's in a large group. They prefer to be more of a smaller size, or even just one or two people that they don't even know would be better than a whole big large group, like a huge cruise.
Right.
And then we also have a segment of our solo retirees who want to travel but have a hard time finding people to travel with.
Right.
Yes, and that's a question I get asked often with solo travelers. They say, well, can you team me up with someone? I know that there are solo travel clubs out there, and that's not something we do. But what we would rather do is, if we're talking about a tour, find the right tour for them where it's a small group of people. A couple of years ago, for example, I went to Ireland on a tour, a small group tour. It was actually with G Adventures. And the age range was from about 30 years old up to 80. And we had four single people on the trip, but we only had 10 people on the tour. So they didn't feel as if they were in a mass of people. They had the option to share and reduce their costs. This is another feature about solo travel, is that you do have this opportunity to be teamed up with someone you don't know, of the same sex, obviously. That's a bit of a tough one. And I have heard some horror stories of being teamed up with somebody you don't know and you end up not liking very much. So if you can find the option to travel solo without that huge single supplement, then I think that's the way to go. Small group gives you security. You have a tour leader who's looking after you. And people have come back to me and they've said, oh, wow, I met up some lovely people and now we're going to meet up again and travel together. So it forms relationships as well with people who have a similar lifestyle, but maybe they live at opposite ends of the world.
You've mentioned Ireland. What are the other most common destinations for solo travelers today?
Well, Italy comes up on top all the time for solos and people traveling as a couple. It's just one of those destinations that seems to be on the bucket list with Tuscany, Rome, and Sicily now is coming up as well after that White Lotus TV series we had. Everybody's curious about going to Sicily. So traditionally for solo travelers, I think they like to kind of stick to maybe North America or Europe. It seems a little bit safer. But once they've got their experience, then they want to start launching out and maybe look at South America or Asia or one of those destinations.
Leslie, is it actual like tours that are happening with solo travelers, or what activities do a lot of the solo travelers that come to you, what do they want to do? Because of course you want to go see all the sites,
yeah,
for example, in Italy, but are there other activities that solo travelers want to do?
Well, solo travelers, for the most part, I think, are quite adventurous. So they want to do things that are active. I get a lot of requests for hiking, walking, particularly. I think as well, they want to learn about the destination. Solo travelers that I deal with tend to be in the little bit older demographic, because I think young people traveling solo are much more adventurous. So as you say, your solo retirees, they want to learn about places. They don't just want to go somewhere and sit on a beach. That's right. They've done that. They want to go to a place where it will be enriching, that's full of culture, where they will have a knowledgeable guide who will teach them about the destination.
You made a very interesting point, Leslie, about how does somebody start if they're, let's say they're suddenly single, right? And they've not done this before. How do you start, right? It doesn't have to be the European Grand Tour. I think you can start with something small and a little bit more local and get your confidence level. But speaking to that, for those that are listening right now that perhaps have been reticent to do that, give us your advice. How would a person start venturing out to get back into this notion of travel and the travel experience if they find themselves suddenly single and they don't know what to do?
Right. Yes. Look, it is a big, scary step. And I think part of that is sitting down and speaking to a professional. Go and see a travel agent, someone you can actually sit at a desk with. I find that is a very popular thing now. People want to come in and talk about their travel. They don't want to do it online or over the phone. And I think face-to-face makes that first-time solo traveler feel much more confident and secure. And enables them to open up, because that's the whole thing. It's communication. If I, as a travel agent, understand your fears, your needs, your desires, I can pick the right place. So it's really all about communication.
I think that makes good sense. Put a plan together and ask somebody who's got some experience, right? Help you out. Okay. Leslie, I want to thank you very much for sharing some, I think, some terrific advice and shining some light on this idea of solo travel and how companies are actually responding to that. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been joined by Leslie Caters, the CEO and the founder of The Travel Lady. Okay. One of the things that you bug me about all the time is healthcare and the focus on healthcare. And I think as we get older, and you're not there yet, I keep bugging you, look into your future, it will become more important. And there's some frustrations around Canadian healthcare in terms of queuing up and how do I get access when I need to and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of things changing, including technology, that I think is going to make an impact in the delivery of healthcare in the future.
I can only imagine what your doctor goes through as you enter into that room and you have to sit in the waiting room waiting for your doctor. And then you have to then get called, go to another room to wait for the doctor. Right. And then the doctor comes. I know we're called patients, but you don't really have much of it. And so I think when I saw the Rocket Doctor and the platform that they have, I honestly thought of you and I go, this is perfect for someone who lacks patience.
Right.
And more, of course, there's more to it, but I thought of you, I'm like,
Well, let's find out a little bit about what the Rocket Doctor is. So Dr. William Cherniak, who's an emergency room physician, he's also the CEO and the founder of Rocket Doctor, is joining us on the show today. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start right off the bat? Tell us about Rocket Doctor.
Yeah, that was funny. Hopefully to help with your patients. But basically, we're quite different, actually, from other folks listening to this may have even never heard of virtual care before. And it's relatively new across Canada, but particularly, you know, Alberta. But even more kind of unique is the way that we've structured our system, where we really seek to empower physicians to build and scale our own independent, largely virtual practices. And then what we do as a company is we create this kind of marketplace approach where patients can, who need healthcare, come onto the website, they can request to book an appointment. And then what Rocket Doctor does in the middle is connect patients with the doctor who's right for you, whether they're an emergency physician or a family doctor, but asking physicians to tell us, what are you confident and comfortable managing virtually? We connect the two together. And then rather than just kind of a walk-in clinic, that doctor is empowered to practice medicine. So can order blood work, imaging, make specialist referrals, book follow-up appointments, but has the ability to kind of share care with dozens of other physicians on the platform across the province who can kind of help them manage what you need for healthcare. And so we try to basically really expand access to care, particularly for folks in rural remote communities, for those who may not have access to a family doctor. And ideally, the whole focus as an emergency physician is how do we prevent those unnecessary ER visits and improve access to care.
Now, Bill, at the beginning of the pandemic, many people were trying to get virtual care. Some had to use some platforms that were not approved or paid for by Alberta Healthcare. So you go to that platform, you pay a fee, and away you go. My understanding is Rocket Doctor is, and the platform now, all through Alberta Healthcare. Is that correct?
Yeah. So my personal background is 10 years in the global health and nonprofit space. And my sort of primary focus, again, was how do we build a system that empowers doctors to practice medicine within the public healthcare system? And so certain places across Canada are debating what to do about publicly funded care codes. But thankfully, in Alberta, the province has kept remuneration feasible for physicians to practice medicine virtually using the public sector health insurance, using your Alberta Health. And so, yeah, in Alberta, you can just take your Alberta Health card. You don't have to pay anything to see a physician on the platform.
And when you look at how you match the doctors, some would have concerns about the screening process of what type of doctor, the experience, or any type of filtering process that you go through to put them as a roster, like I would say on the docket that would match. How do you determine which doctors are the right doctors for this platform and which doctors maybe shouldn't be on this sort of a platform?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, physicians on the platform are our customers. Like, we don't have a corporate practice group or anything like that. Each doctor is independent. So just as you would kind of look for, we've kind of helped to streamline the process. So, you know, they're all licensed Alberta physicians that are geographically in the province who are practicing medicine. We do, of course, vet that to make sure they're real doctors and have, you know, insurance and all that other stuff. But then once they're on the platform, it's really, we leave it up to the patient and the provider. So if you have a good initial experience, you get along well, leave it up to you. You talk to that doctor. If you both decide you want to continue, you know, seeing one another and follow-up appointments, you're, you know, welcome to do that. If you say as a patient, well, I'd like to, you know, get a different physician next time available, you can do that too. And we leave that choice up to the kind of patient and doctor to go from there, essentially. But we certainly make sure everybody's a real physician who's on the platform.
Yeah, fair enough. What was the unmet need? So when you started this, you became passionate about doing this. For what reason? Was it, as you said, scaling practices? Was it there was an unmet patient need? Well, you know, where did it come from?
Yeah, I mean, my background is in the nonprofit. So I started a group called Bridge to Health Medical and Dental about 10 years ago, working primarily in sub-Saharan East Africa. And through work in rural Uganda, got involved in a high-tech diagnostics and devices, particularly a tool called point-of-care ultrasound, and training local physicians in Uganda how to diagnose pneumonia in kids using this cloud-based teleradiology system, where we could basically upload images and have a bunch of Canadian doctors give feedback virtually. And so that managed to get some press in the New York Times and across Canada. And so kind of pushed me personally in the tech sector. And then as an ER physician in the fall of 2019, before the pandemic, actually, there were just lots of patients coming to the hospital with outpatient primary care issues who couldn't get a family doctor. Right. And so I was thinking to myself, you know, if we could combine diagnostics and technology and virtual care, maybe we could get people access without having to wait for however long you have to wait to see me in the emergency department, if you don't need the emergency department and you can be provided care outside the hospital. And so started to put the pieces together. And then the pandemic hit in the spring of 2020, and it was really the sort of right time to really dive in at first.
Two-part question for you, Bill. On the patient side, what kind of technology is being used? Because we're going to have different demographics that have different comfort with technology. I'm going to look at the people who are some of our clients who do not want to do stuff online. They would prefer to do it face-to-face or over the phone, but need this type of service because they want to get that kind of care. So from a technology perspective, let's take a look at what the patient has to go through. And then what about security? Because we're now using the internet and we are sharing information with all the stuff that we hear about and some of the scary things with the technology, the way it's moving, how much privacy is protected for the patient as well?
Yeah, I mean, so the first point, we make it as easy as humanly possible. So there's no complicated app you have to download or anything. It's just a browser-based extension. So you'd go to rocketdoctor.ca, you click the province that you're in, you fill in some basic information, and you send the form off, and that's it. Someone from our team will give you a phone call. They'll walk you through the appointment. They'll talk about the tech and kind of help you to get set up. So that's as simple as possible for patients. And we've just released a patient portal that we're starting to roll out to folks to make it even easier to get follow-up as well. On the privacy side, that's our primary concern, honestly, is making sure that everything we do is as secure and safe as possible. So interestingly, in Canada, we don't have really federal legislation around health data privacy. It's devolved to the provinces largely. But the United States has the, you know, HIPAA, Health Information Act. And so we basically work off of the most strict requirements, and we try to match that for every province that we're in. And of course, each province has their kind of own flavor of regulatory mix that we make sure we're abiding by. And we do basically everything within our power to try to keep data safe and the system secure.
Okay. Who would, I think I've got an idea about this, but maybe just before we finish up the segment, talk to us a little bit about, the type of patient that you're seeing. What first came to mind for me was there's so many people that don't have a primary care doctor, right? They're frustrated. And I'm sure you see a lot of those in the emergency room. But I'm curious, is that who your patient is, or what's the demographic and what's the, you know, the top three reasons why people are doing this?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, that's about how we know, we've done analyses, and about 50% of patients on the platform do not have a family doctor and live in a rural or remote community. And I do emergency medicine shifts across rural Alberta, actually. So I'll be working a shift on the 5th in a small town in the south of the province. And I've worked in the north and otherwise. And folks that come into those places, like less than 25% have a family doctor. Yeah. So, and I've met patients, funnily, in northern Alberta who through organically have just, I've said, how are you going to get follow-up? They go, you know, there's this really interesting thing called Rocket Doctor I'm using. And so I couldn't help but smile and think, well, this is good. It's actually touching folks who want to. And then there's other patients as well. You might be in Calgary or Edmonton or otherwise in a major urban center, and maybe you can't get to your family doctor because they're away or on vacation, or maybe you've got a more urgent problem. You're not sure really, do I need the ER otherwise? And so we allow, of course, folks in those situations to also see, or maybe you have something that's stigmatizing where you're a little embarrassed and you're not sure, you know, does it make sense to go in? And so the top three reasons typically why folks would come in could be something simple like an upper respiratory, you know, cough, cold, flu symptoms, you're not sure. But also we see people coming in with mental health concerns, with, you know, diabetes, high blood pressure. And the physicians on the platform are full scope licensed physicians, so they can manage anything that they're confident clinically to manage virtually, basically.
Bill, thank you very much. We appreciate that. Okay, we got to wrap this thing up, but we've been joined by Dr. William Cherniak, who's an emergency room physician, CEO and founder of Rocket Doctor Healthcare. The medical industry is an interesting one. Great conversation with Bill. It's tied around 6-7 minute meetings to get the information you need to protect the most important asset class you have, which is truly your health. Yeah. Right.
So let's that picture that you're saying is that when a patient visits their family physician or online, it's usually 6-7 minutes.
about your financial health? How does a financial industry look at the financial health through a financial plan? Because I think there's some similarities, Faisal. You're
gonna get me going now, Dave. Yep. Here it is. I think the 7-minute financial plan is happening.
Right.
And so for the people who are looking for an advisor or a firm to help them with their financial future, many people can whip through a financial plan, create one in 7 minutes.
Yep.
It's very easy to do. And every time you put a financial plan, and a retirement plan is a mathematical calculation. Just make the math work,
right,
and you're fine.
Right.
And I think this is going to be a destruction to people's retirement because they're taking a 7-minute financial plan. The people are plugging numbers in. They're giving you a response saying, here you go. You're perfectly fine. Don't worry about it. These are the numbers. And you're good. See you later. Bye.
Can we talk about some simple math around that? I mean, you know, we're talking, I don't want to go into complex stuff, but let's give people an example of where some of these problems exist. Okay. Number one, I think you stated correctly. We throw something together in 7 minutes by just inputting data and it spits out some form of report.
So let me tell you where the story came from.
Okay.
A couple, let's name them Richard and Sarah just for easy purposes. Richard and Sarah met with me. They brought their financial plan that was done by another team, yep, advisor at another institution. And it was literally a 15-minute meeting, mm-hmm, Dave, mm-hmm, 15-minute meeting. They met with the individual. They said, can you help me out with my financial plan? And so I can retire. What can you do for me?
Right.
Quote unquote. They whipped out a financial plan within 15 minutes of the entire meeting, including conversation. They were out and they said, here's my financial plan, Faisal. Can you give me a second opinion on this?
Right.
And I said, how long did it take them to actually put this together? Oh, we were done the meeting in 15 minutes. Okay. I go through the entire document. It's about 30 pages. Okay. Sure, they got some number and calculations. They basically put in some assumptions.
Yeah.
So first, how much income do you need? They said the number. They used a rate of return. They used an estimate of inflation over the next 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it spits out the kind of cash flow and income that they can receive for the rest of their lives.
Yep.
And it said 100% success rate.
Yep.
Here you go, using that rate of return, that inflation rate, that tax rate, you're good. So they're like, we should just go with that advisor and work with them. Because look, they said I can do it.
Well, they did a financial plan for me. Remember, only 30% of Canadians actually have a written financial plan.
Correct.
Okay. So this is better than 70% of most.
Correct. So you're already ahead of the pace when you already have something in writing.
Right.
Fantastic. Now, is that document the right document?
Right.
So when I started looking at the plan and I said, okay, these are the good, the bad about the plan, I actually brought up the fact that has this been stress tested? Has these numbers that they were using, these assumptions that are put into place, primarily rate of return, inflation, and taxes?
Yes.
Have you run that through every market condition for, let's say, the past 100 years?
Okay, so pause there. It's a bit confusing, right? Pause.
Okay.
Okay. Those assumptions do what? They forecast the future.
Right. So the information you put into a retirement plan is the numbers that you will assume to have every single year for the rest of your life.
So if you put in a 4 or a 5% rate of return or whatever number, what you're saying is that assumes you get that number every single year for the rest of your life.
Correct.
Okay.
And in this case, they used 6% rate of return.
Okay.
And they said, here you go.
Right.
I said, fantastic. And they're like, I should sign up with them.
Right.
How are your rates of return, Faisal?
Right.
Okay. Let's put away the side for rate of return.
Okay.
Let's talk about your plan first, and then we can talk about our portfolios
and
how we've been able to help hundreds of clients to reach their retirement goals. Okay. When you go through the plan, you have that assumption, and you start running that over in the future, you have to assume a couple of things. The numbers, and those numbers are going to be the numbers every single year for the next 35 years.
So pause. Will a portfolio get 6% every single year?
No.
No, it'll be an average of something, right?
And that's the problem.
Right.
You have to use an average rate of return, but the calculation is basing it on every single year is going to happen.
Right.
Okay. So then what do I do is I take those numbers and I run them through every market condition. I stress test it. And what we found out, that 75% of the time, they're okay.
Right.
25% of the time, they are in trouble.
Now, how's that? Why? Why? Why is there a difference? The financial plan said they're 100%.
And I'll use one example only. That rate of return of 6% that was produced in that plan only happens in the last 100 years, 75% of the time.
Right.
Using that mix of investments, because depending on what you use. If you use GICs, it's completely different than if you use emerging market equities, right? There's going to be different variations to the rate of return that you can get over the last 100 years.
So the financial plan is not just a number, but it also has to be attached to a strategy for all these other things, yes?
You can see I'm kind of getting really frustrated at this, because what ended up happening is what they were told was 100%, you're good.
Right.
And then when I come out and I say, you're 75% likely to succeed in your retirement goals, it's like I told them they're never going to be able to make it.
Right.
I didn't say that, but that's how they felt.
Yeah, there's a look on their face, yeah.
And for them to not get the real goods of a seven-minute plan,
right.
It's like literally going to your doctor. And you might have seen these videos that people make fun of doctors sometimes. And to all the doctors, please don't message me. This is just an analogy I'm trying to use. There's a video that's gone out on social media that says the patient comes in, says what's wrong within like 13 seconds. There's a prescription written in a way. But what about this problem? Oh, here's another prescription. Oh, and they just keep on throwing prescription. Right. That's literally what's happening in our industry on the financial side. Right. Oh, you've got a problem. Here's a plan. Let's throw in a nice number, 6-7%. So that's what you can do for me? Yeah, I can do this for you. Look at the average rate of return of the 10-year percent of the portfolio, the 10-year performance of the portfolio. It's done the number that you're saying. You're good. What?
Right.
You can really make a huge negative impact to someone's financial future playing the assumption game.
Yeah, it's too simplistic. It's too simplistic, right? And so we talk a lot about this in our seminar, but the reason there's a difference there is because this notion of your 6% every single year is not going to happen. We call it the sequence of returns. And every single Canadian transitioning to or living in retirement needs to understand how the rules of investing fundamentally change.
And that's why we're going to have two seminars coming up talking about this specific issue of the sequence of return. First, Tuesday, March 19th in Lethbridge at the Sandman Signature Hotel. Second one, April 16th in Calgary at the Silver Springs Golf and Country Club. You do need to register for this. So go to morethanmoneyradio.com to register. That's morethanmoneyradio.com to register.
Okay, and you can download any of our past segments at morethanmoneyradio.com. Please do that or sign up for our podcast. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of More Than Money on QR Calgary. Faisal and I look forward to chatting with you next week.
David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli are portfolio managers and investment advisors with CIBC Woodgundy in Calgary. The views of David Popowich and Faisal Carmelli do not necessarily reflect those of CIBC World Markets Inc. Clients are advised to seek advice regarding their particular circumstances from their personal tax and legal advisors. If you are currently a CIBC Woodgundy client, please contact your investment advisor. CIBC Woodgundy is a division of CIBC World Markets Inc., a subsidiary of CIBC and a member of the Canadian Investor Protection Fund and Investment Industry Regulatory Organization of Canada.